Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. There's no greater symbol of the American West than the American Wild Mustang. Transformative animal for Plains Indians, their diminishing range over the decades is a metaphor for the West in many ways. And over the years, there have been far too many horses than there is land on federal land. First came adoption programs, but many of the horses were far too wild or unadoptable in other ways. Today we hear about the first government-sponsored private wild horse sanctuary, places where the wild horses can run somewhat freely and live with dignity. My guest today is Alan Day, a third-generation rancher and the brother of former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. At one point, he was the owner of three ranches. His home spread, the 175,000-acre Lazy Bee in southern Arizona, the Rex Ranch in the Sand Hills of Nebraska, and a ranch that would become the 35,000-acre Mustang Meadows Ranch on the South Dakota-Nebraska border. His book on creating the first private Mustang sanctuary is titled The Horse Lover, A Cowboy's Quest to Save the Wild Mustang, which tells the story of the preserve, but also the story of the best horses he owned over the years, and it talks about that special relationship between man and horse, and also of his horse whispering techniques, which he learned far earlier than the celebrated book, which he used to make the Mustangs manageable. Alan Day is my guest today. He joins us by phone from southern Arizona. Alan Day, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. I'm glad to be talking to you.
Your new book, The Horse Lovers, tells two stories. It's one, your love of horse. You're a rancher, but you're a horseman. It's very obvious from the book. And you tell a series of stories about the horses you've owned over the years, but you're telling also a bigger story. This work that you did in the late 80s and early 90s to establish among the first wild Mustang sanctuaries. And for you, it all began with a ranch that you didn't own, that you really didn't even need, but you fell in love with, and that was the Arnold Ranch, just north of the South Dakota-Nebraska border.
That's exactly right. A friend of mine kept calling me saying, you need to come look at this ranch. And I, at the time, was the owner and manager of two ranches, which was a bigger job than I could handle with two ranches. And I said, no, I'm full of ranches, don't need any more. And he kept calling, saying, but you need to see this ranch. And he even one time, he said, Alan, he said, I'll show you something you've never seen on a ranch. In the same tree, I'll show you wild turkeys, grouse, and pheasant, all in the same tree. And he said, no other place in the country can have that. And by golly, he was right. And so, you know, that doesn't constitute a good ranch, but it certainly drew my interest. So when I finally gave in and said, okay, I'll go look, it was just to get him off my back, you know, just to stop him calling me. So, but I had this amazing experience. The ranch road is 10 miles long and at the time was full of potholes and a terrible road. But as we drove in, the closer we got to the ranch, somehow I knew what was ahead, what I was going to see, what I would feel, what I would see, and all I can say is maybe in some other life I've been there. And I've never had that feeling in my life before, but I did then. So by the time I got to the headquarters, number one, I knew what I was going to see when I got there, but I was just totally in love with the place. So it was like coming home. It was like being gone from a long journey and then coming home was the feeling. And so I didn't tell him what was happening, but that moment determined that if I can, I need to bond with this ranch. I need to be here. I need to own it. I need to be involved with this ranch. So,
and it is, it's classic tall grass prairie up in the Sand Hills. It's the little section of the Sand Hills that go across the South Dakota border. You have a river that runs through it, abundant water because you're on the Ogallala Aquifer, and I assume you just have gorgeous tall grass prairie there.
It is the prettiest ranch I've ever seen, and you're exactly right. That tall grass prairie waving in the breeze and the gentle sandy hills that just keep rolling forever there, and the colors and 26 different varieties of grass. And then not all of the Sand Hills ranches have the wet meadows, the sub-irrigated meadows, but this ranch has 3,000 acres of sub-irrigated meadows to cut the hay on, or for whatever use you want, but sub-irrigated meadows, which give it winter capacity. You can cut all the hay you want and feed the cattle or the horses in the winter. And then to top that off, it's got about 10 places, or 8, I guess, where somebody way ahead of me planted big 40-acre plots of trees, evergreen trees, pines and cedars, in rows that run from northeast to southwest. And when the winter blizzards come, they all come from the northwest. So these trees were aligned so that they would be windbreaks, and that all, not all, but most of the snow would hit these bands of trees and go out. And just on the lee side of these trees was just wonderful winter windbreak and cover for the cattle or the horses. So it was just set up so beautifully for ranching in that world.
Well, originally I assume you planned on putting cattle there, but very soon another person came into your life who gave you a new idea.
Well, Dayton Hyde is this character, and he's a dreamer and a writer and a storyteller and just an interesting man. But he had become involved in the plight of the wild horses, and the government did have and still has a bunch of excess unadoptable wild horses, and those are horses that have been gathered off of the native range where they are because there are too many. The horses reproduce too fast, and if left alone, they'll produce so many horses that they'll all starve. You know, they outproduce the land's ability to give them feed. So periodically the government has to cut down on the numbers, and the young pretty ones all go into the adoption program, and hopefully people fall in love with them and adopt them. But then there's maybe an equal number that are old or one-eyed or crippled or ugly or mean or whatever. and those are the unadoptables. And those were just in holding facilities, and meaning feedlots. Just they were warehoused in feedlots that the government just paid somebody to haul feed to them every day. And those horses, our heritage tells us that those horses should be running out on the range, and that it's not a happy end to have them standing in feedlots, bored to death and eating each other's manes and tails and just standing in a feedlot. So Dayton wanted to take those excess unadoptables, unloved, unwanted horses, and put them back out on the range and have a happy old horse retirement home, a place for them to run on the wonderful prairie and do what those horses do, and if need be, grow old and pass on in a happy environment.
And this would have been, what, about late 1980s or early 1990s?
88. Yes.
And so at that point, he convinces you that the Arnold Ranch, which you were in the process of buying, would make a great wild Mustang sanctuary. And so you began to investigate it. First of all, the Bureau of Land Management had not thought of doing anything like this. The people that actually worked with the animals said, these critters are just too mean, they're too wild, they'll jump the fence and you'll be chasing them for miles. But you guys had a vision. You had to even go to Congress to get sanctuaries passed. Tell us about that experience.
Well, you're right. The Bureau of Land Management liked our idea. By the way, when Dayton first came to me, he had this small ranch up near Hot Springs, and he said, well, he wanted help because he wanted to take horses and put them up there. But he said, well, I can only handle 300, and in fact, there are close to 2,000 horses altogether in that category. So I had just bought the ranch and hadn't decided yet what to do with it. When I bought it, there were no cattle on it. It was just there. It was a little jewel that was waiting for somebody to have a vision about cattle or sheep or tourists or whatever to, you know, for a use for it. So when he started talking about that, and the numbers seemed to fit, I thought, gee whiz, maybe he can get his 300 and then the rest I could handle on the bigger ranch. And so it was almost like serendipity or something. It seemed like it was meant to be. But then the Bureau, we went, and I had good relationship with the Bureau of Land Management. That's really why Dayton got hold of me, is because he wanted me to be his front man to deal with the BLM, Bureau of Land Management.
We should mention your Lazy Bee Ranch in southern Arizona is, what, about 180,000 acres, something like that? It was a large dry land ranching operation.
That's true, but it was 76% federal lease.
Yeah.
So I had a whole history of dealing with the BLM and knew a lot of people in the Bureau of Land Management and had good relations with them. So he wanted me to kind of go with him and introduce him to the powers in the Bureau of Land Management. When he first talked to me, he didn't have any idea that I had enough land that I could actually be an active part of the management. But, you know, one thing led to another, and I said, well, let me sign on for the, you know, for this ranch I'm just purchasing. But anyway, the Bureau of Land Management said, well, we like your idea, but we don't think we have the authority to contract with you, so you need to go persuade Congress to allow us to contract with you. So Dayton and I should have probably hired lobbyists. That's how you do it. But we didn't know that, so we decided, well, we'll just saddle up our horse and go to Washington. And so here were two cowboys walking down the halls of Congress. We got a kick out of the stares that we got and the jokes that, you know, people would, we'd meet staff there and they'd say, well, did you park your horse out in front? And so we had actually it was an enjoyable time, and we had a good story to tell. So the congressmen and senators that we talked to were uniformly very pleasant to us and were in favor of the idea. So they finally put a rider on one bill that was going through that was a, you know, small rider, saying that the Bureau could contract with private people to for the care of the wild horses.
Well, eventually the wild horses did come to what became known as Mustang Meadows Ranch. That's what you renamed the ranch. And what did you have, 1,500 head, 2,000 head at some point?
No, I took 1,500 head,
yeah.
Yes.
What was it like to see those horses running across the prairie?
Amazing, and that's under describing it. We would keep the horses all in one herd, even though they could have scattered over the whole ranch. We would keep them in one pasture at a time, you know, maybe one-tenth of the ranch, and then move them almost every week to fresh pasture. We had this rest rotation grazing system that would benefit the grass a lot. And so when you would see the horses, they would all 1,500 would be in one herd and not in a very big place. And so you'd go out there and ride through them. We taught them to follow us when we would ride through there. So we'd ride through the bunch and say, come on, boys, we're headed for new pasture. And they'd fall right in behind you, and you'd hit an easy gallop out across that beautiful prairie, and you'd have 1,500 horses galloping 8 feet behind you. And what a thrill that is. You can hear the thunder of the hooves and hear them breathing and hear them nickering into each other, and the wind in your face, and you turn around and look, and oh my goodness, the adrenaline starts running, you know, because here's this thundering herd of horses right there behind you. And so I had that experience so many times. I always loved doing that, but I always hope my horse didn't stumble and fall. That might not have been fun.
My guest today is Alan Day, a rancher, a horseman who helped establish the first wild Mustang sanctuaries, among the first, and he's the author of The Horse Lover, A Cowboy's Quest to Save the Wild Mustangs, which not only tells the story of the creation of that sanctuary, but also his love of horses and the great horses that were a part of his life as a rancher. I want to ask you, one of the most fascinating parts of the book was you were doing these techniques well before the horse whisperer craze, but you basically started out with cattle as a cattle whisperer of sorts. You, on your dry ranching spread in Arizona, you turn those cattle out, they kind of go wild. And so what you learned to do was, at a very young age, get them very used to men on horseback, so that when you would round them up, they would come and you wouldn't have to chase them all over everywhere. And you sort of took the same approach with Mustangs. And I know that that was one of the big issues was, how are you going to get these wild Mustangs to, I mean, if you want them to go this way, they're going to go the other just out of sheer spite. And there were a number of times when that happened anyway, but you put these sort of whispering techniques into place that really got them where they would do your bidding.
Well, yes, we did. And to start with, the reader needs to understand that we profess as a society here in the U.S. to be the friend of the horse, you know, and we have these groups that want to save the horse and be the friend, but we're really the horse's worst enemy. All of the bad things that happen in wild horse life that are fearful and gives them terror is caused by man. We chase them with helicopters, and we force them into corrals, and then we split up their families, and we force them to do things that just totally frighten them. So all of their experiences with man have taught them that we're their worst enemy. So I felt that I needed to teach them that here's one man that's your friend, and that I won't mistreat you. I won't terrorize you. We can communicate. I learn to speak your language. You teach me your language, and we can talk. And so they accepted that. They said, okay, we'll do that. And so I became their friend, and they looked at me as an alpha male in their life. And in horse families, they always have an alpha male that tells them what to do, and then the horses all follow the lead of the alpha male. So I learned their language, got them to accept me as the alpha male, and then they'd look up and say, oh, it's you, what do you want? Yeah. And instead of looking up and saying, oh, my God, it's the enemy, I got to run as fast as I can. And that, by definition, is horse whispering.
Yeah, I noticed that your ranch hands were a little skeptical at first, because basically it was spending time in a corral and basically trying to get as close as you could to them before they would scatter and basically run away.
Yes, in fact, it was harder to teach the ranch hands the new technique than it was to teach the horses, because the ranch hands' idea of if a cow gets wild, you get on a faster horse than the cow is, and you outrun them and turn them back. Same with horses. The difference is that we didn't have fast enough horses to outrun the horses. So if they wanted to run away, they could run away. So you have to have a whole different mindset and say, look, I'm going to be nice to these horses and talk to them and have them understand and me understand them, and then they won't want to run away.
And there was a really interesting thing they would do that was almost like a language, which you began to interpret as they're accepting your authority. It was like a bit of a pawing. And what was the behavior, actually?
Well, they do have a language, and their language is nonverbal. It's the way they face, and it's how they hold their ears and how they look at you and how they hold their head. And they have their language, and we learned quite a little of the language. The part that we wanted to learn was their acceptance language. You know, I accept you. And that was, one ear would go up, the other ear forward. They would start chewing, but they wouldn't have anything in their mouth to chew. They would just be chewing with their mouth, and they would bob their head up and down, and then usually they would paw one front foot, pawing on the ground. And that was them saying, okay, I accept you. The neat thing about that was that once they said that, they never retracted on it. You were always their friend then. And even if you didn't see them for a month or 2 months, if they had given you that acceptance, when you would show back up, they would know who you were, and they would accept you.
Wow.
They didn't have to give you that signal each time, but they would. They just, once they gave it, it was forever.
I was really interested in how you know, these are wild Mustangs, and some of them have got their own opinions about everything. And when you had one that would break the herd, you know, you weren't scaring them or hot-shotting them or anything like that. But I think there was one where it was like it just kept getting away, and finally it was almost like a parent scolding a child and said, get back with the herd, and you managed to scare it enough to the point where it behaved. It was really quite interesting, because it was like taking care of a two-year-old.
It's just about like taking care of a three-year-old. It reminds you of kindergarten when the teacher says, okay, everybody line up and hold hands, we're going to walk to lunch. The first time she says that, they scatter everywhere, and it takes maybe 10 times before they all get in line and know what needs to be done and do it. So it's very much the same.
My guest today is Alan Day, a rancher who helped establish one of the first wild Mustang sanctuaries. His book is titled The Horse Lover, A Cowboy's Quest to Save the Wild Mustangs. And for several years, you had a wonderful existence on this ranch. I mean, you basically turned over your other ranches, it sounds like, to other people, to foremen and folks, and your wife, while you were dealing with these wild Mustangs, which must have given you a great enjoyment. But after a while, you know, the whole idea of this Mustang sanctuary, and I hope it's changed now, but in the early days, there were a lot of people at the BLM that just saw this as an asset of some sort or another. You were asked to round up a number of the oldest, ugliest, and heaviest horses for some reason. You don't know what that reason is, but you intimate that it was probably being sold for horse meat.
Well, the Bureau did not sell horses directly, but the price of horse flesh went way up from maybe 20 cents a pound all the way up to 80 cents a pound. When that happened, then a lot of individuals saw opportunity there, and they could adopt one or 10 or five. They allowed multiple adoptions, and they could hold them for a year, and then the BLM would give them deed to the horse, and then they owned the horse with no restrictions, and then they could sell it. And so if it was a 1,000-pound horse, it would sell for $800. They paid $150 to adopt the horse. So a lot of people said, boy, this is a good investment. I'll adopt 10 of these horses for $1,500. In a year, I'll sell them for $8,000. Mm. And so people did that. And that's why they had me cut out the biggest ones, because at that point in time, the bigger the horse was, the more he would sell for, you know, by the pound. So the BLM didn't directly sell the horses, but you knew that they were giving tacit approval to that, or they wouldn't have asked me to cut out the big ones.
Now, you also ran afoul of a county attorney who was trying to, I guess, make a name by busting the wild Mustang sanctuary owner. You had a horrible tragedy of... Ice was built up, and you had a little warming thaw, and several horses fell through the ice and died. And apparently that had been a problem at the ranch for generations. Your foreman had told you other incidents had happened that with cattle. But this attorney came in and basically charged you with malnourishment. Of course, there was nothing to that, and you were exonerated. But there were a lot of people out there that wanted to see this fail. For whatever reason, whether it was at the Bureau of Indian Affairs or this county attorney or eventually at some aspects of the BLM itself.
That's exactly true. It our neighbors and people that came out there and wanted to see the horses running free just got big smiles on their faces and were happy. But when there is success, some people get jealous of the success. And I had some friends in the BLM that were close enough friends, they'd tell me, you know, what was really going on. And several of them told me that there were people in the mid-level of the Bureau of Land Management that said, well, Alan wouldn't be successful if it weren't for his big sister that's on the Supreme Court. And he used her influence to get the sanctuary. And he's bulletproof because she's his sister. And so if we can, we're going to get even with him, or, you know, do harm to him or whatever. Just jealousy.
Interesting. And in fact, eventually you lost your contract. You were underbid by one penny. And the fact that there was all sorts of shenanigans with the bidding process because they weren't even giving you the information you needed to make a bid. And eventually you lost the Mustangs there at the ranch. But it sounds like it was an incredible time while it lasted. And I really don't know a whole lot about the current program. I see that there are still sanctuaries to this day. Has a lot of the shenanigans sort of gone out of this program today, so it's well run?
I really don't know the ins and outs of the program. I do know that Roy Houck from Oklahoma came up and toured our sanctuary and looked at it, and he said it to me. He said, I want one of these, meaning I want a sanctuary. And I said, well, you can do the same thing I did. Go out and sell yourself to the BLM that you've got a good ranch and, you know, whatever, and maybe they'll issue a contract to you. Well, in fact, what they did is take my contract away and ship my horses directly to him. And why they decided to do that, I don't know. When the Bureau would do something that I thought was really stupid, I didn't hesitate to step up and say, you shouldn't do that. That's really dumb. And they may not have liked that. One time they said, well, we want to microchip all the horses. Yeah. And I said, well, why would you want to do that? And they said, well, if one dies, then we can scan them. And I said, well, you better get there pretty quick, because in 24 hours, the coyotes will have them eaten clear down to bones, you know. And so you may have to run a coyote down to scan them. And so I think that's a dumb idea. Well, they didn't like to hear that, because that idea probably got somebody a promotion on his resume. I don't know. And so, you know, things like that, it wasn't huge controversy, but I didn't, when I knew it was not a viable idea, I didn't hesitate to tell them.
Well, not only do you tell the story about the Wild Mustang Sanctuary, you also tell us stories about some of the great horses that have been a part of your life. Just to name a couple of them, there was Candy, Aunt Jemima, and Saber. What horse meant the most to you, and why?
You know, the very best horse that I ever threw my leg over was Saber, and he was a horse that I owned the stallion, I owned the mare. I had ridden his big sister, you know, before Saber came along, so I knew the genetics. I knew that his sister was just this good, solid horse, and then Saber came along, and he was just super horse. And, oh, my goodness, he was a little tough when I broke him. He was a little hard-headed, but all horses will test you a little. But when he finally said, we're bonded and I cooperate, oh, my goodness, it was so nice to ride him, because you would just think a thought and he would do it. And he would do it better than any horse you ever rode, you know. And he could run faster than any horse I ever rode. He could turn quicker. He could cut cattle. You know, he just was an amazing horse. And he'd look at me and I'd just melt, you know. We just had such a bond. I have a... makes me emotional to even think about Saber.
Well, and there are a number of horses that you tell the story of, and there's that love that's evident. This is a wonderful book. The name of the book is The Horse Lover. Alan, I so appreciate your time. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, I'm so pleased that you called, and good luck with your endeavors.
Third-generation rancher Alan Day speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His book is titled The Horse Lover, A Cowboy's Quest to Save the Wild Mustangs. It's published by the University of Nebraska Press. Well, at Studio Tulsa for today, our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.